My name is Catherine McDowell. I'm an associate professor of Old Testament at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I teach Hebrew, exegesis, and hermeneutics.
And I'm Philip Towner, living in Hoboken, New Jersey, retired from working with the Bible Society, but still teaching as a professor in Rome at the Pontifical Urbaniana University, where we are developing a program in Bible translation, and my field there is translation studies.
Dr. McDowell, Dr. Towner, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's a delight. And we're going to be talking about your book, The Rewards of Learning Greek and Hebrew. Now, nobody can see this. I'm holding this book up, but nobody can see it because it's audio only, but I want them to see it. We'll put a picture of the cover on the show notes. But the subtitle is Discovering the Richness of the Bible in Its Original Languages. And that is really perfect for our podcast because at the Lanier Theological Library, I am teaching Greek at night. And we're looking for somebody to start teaching Hebrew. But we have about 40 people from the ages of about 11 to 80 who are studying Greek right now. And it's really a lot of fun with them. There's no tests, there's no quizzes, there's no papers to write. We just come together and do Greek on Tuesday nights. So it's really delightful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, so tell me a little bit about this book, Dr. Towner. Let's start with you. What's the big idea behind the book? What were you trying to do?
I think the big idea was to promote the study of the biblical languages in a time and a context, I guess, where it's become less interesting in some ways to people who are doing biblical studies, even going through seminary programs. So many seminaries now don't offer the languages, or certainly don't offer enough classes in the languages so that students can actually become functional, can gain a facility with the language. So what we were trying to do, Kathy with Hebrew and Old Testament, myself with Greek and New Testament, was to sort of introduce readers, prospective students, we hope, to the things that are, if you like, hidden in translation or not translatable into our favorite, you know, English versions, things which are accessible only through Hebrew and Greek. And if I could just read a statement that's on the back of the book, which you're not showing to anyone.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah. Here we go. We'll show it.
The statement is made, biblical studies remains an unfinished task, and reading the biblical language is the foundation of the task. So I think both Kathy and I are looking beyond just the study of the languages, which can be interesting just in and of itself. But we're looking beyond that to, in a sense, equipping students who will then step into the business of biblical studies at a high academic level and carry on that task of the church.
So, Kathy, why do you think we've seen the change that we've seen in the last 30, 40 years in seminary training? And I know it's hard to diagnose all this where we're sitting, but you teach in a school and in an area where people have had that in the past, but now there's not the demand for it. They're really, I don't want to say dumbing down theological education, but they're making it, they're not stressing the classical sort of disciplines, are they?
No, you're exactly right. We've seen this across the board at so many schools, as Phil mentioned. And I think, to be honest, at the root of it really is money. That if seminaries are going to, or divinity schools are going to attract students, enrollment is down across the country. And I don't know what it's like internationally, but in the US, it's certainly down. And so in order to attract students, a lot of seminaries are making degrees easier to get, shorter, fewer requirements. And typically the languages are among the hardest seminary courses. And so I guess the thinking is if you make the degree a little easier, the first thing you're going to get rid of are the toughest courses, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I was talking with someone recently, and he said one of the reasons that he wanted to take Greek and Hebrew at the seminary level was because he had a pastor growing up who very often would sort of not lead with that, but talk about that, make that a part of his teaching and preaching. We just don't see that kind of preaching, Dr. Towner, much anymore, do we?
Well, as an Episcopal priest who preaches regularly, it's something I practice. But yeah, going back in time myself, you know, back into the 70s and 80s when I was getting into college and all that, I remember pastors who would say, and the Greek says, or the Hebrew says, and we'd all kind of groan because, you know, I mean, it got to be a kind of mantra, almost like a magic formula. We're not seeing it. What I teach in Rome, one of the universities is the Pontifical Biblical Institute, which is the Jesuit grad school. And every time I'm there, the older professors especially ask me, how are the students doing with languages? Because for them, I mean, these are the older priest scholars who are retired, but they're still part of the community and they've taught for years. They're still reeling from Vatican II and, you know, its impact, of course, first of all, on Latin. But generally, in that context, too, there are students coming from the global south who don't have all the benefits of education that students coming from the North and the West, especially European and U.S. students would have. As Kathy mentioned, now, if we just think of the American educational situation, there's so much competition for curriculum time among the professors. And in order to get students, I think some of the seminaries have had to focus more on what I guess I would call the sexy programs, everything from leadership to counseling. I have no problem with these things, but something has to give. And in order to promote and offer those kinds of attractive programs that will bring the students, something has to give. And as Kathy said, it tends to be the hard courses. And the other part, of course, is the advance of computer technology and all of the Bible software available makes a lot of people think that actually learning to parse Greek verbs or deal with Hebrew verbs and so forth, it's just not necessary anymore because your cursor flies over that screen and boom, up pops the parsing for you. And okay, it's a great tool. And I think some of those who are teaching the biblical languages now are making good use of the computer tools. But the ease of navigating through one program or another that has the biblical languages there, it is in a way a kind of deterrent to learning the languages the old way. I don't mean necessarily old technology, but it to the degree where you actually have a reading ability with the language. Well, everything's stacked against that right now.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. One of the things you guys have in the back of the book are these QR codes to places like Bible Mesh, Bible eLearning, Biblingo, and places like that. We've discussed that with some of the people of those programs who've been on our podcast before. How successful do you think people are if they just say, I just want to tune in online and I want to learn this online? It's something like Bible Mesh or something, some program like that. Kathy, do you have any sense? I mean, you teach online some, right?
I do. I do some online teaching for sure. So I think it can be effective for folks who are highly disciplined and highly motivated, but that's not most of us.
we need a good kick in the pants sometimes.
Yeah, and I think we need the community, frankly, the community of learners, which is just not only helpful in mastering content, but also in really encouraging each other. So when I reflect on the way that the way that I learned Hebrew, it was in Greek in a class, live, in person, and I made lifelong friends in those classes that started out as my study partners for Greek and Hebrew. And those relationships were really helpful in learning the language, actually. And that you can do this online to a degree, right? If you want to buddy up with someone in your class through Zoom and meet together. So it's not impossible to do. But I do think technology, as Phil said, does have a bit of a detrimental impact, even though it has, you know, it offers us some wonderful things as well.
Mm-hmm. I have talked to some people who are very proficient in Greek and Hebrew over the years, who learned sort of on their own before there was this technology. Now there are others trying to do it with technology. But it seems to me the better pattern, Phil, is to be in a kind of a formal setting like Kathy was talking about. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, and I'd agree with everything Kathy said in terms of the possibilities that are there with the technology. But the one word I would add, and the one dimension, is probably that of the accountability of students who take these courses for credit. Who, now, going back to the old way of doing it, that meant for me when I was learning first year Greek, we had it 5 days a week. The requirement suggested we study 2 hours outside of class for every hour in, and every day there was a quiz and there were examinations. And so that kind of thing gets us beyond, well, it pushes us beyond in terms of discipline. And of course, you sort out the goats from the sheep, or however you want to say that too.
Yeah.
But without that need that is in some respects accountability oriented, and in some respects it's about performance, the basics will not be learned. They will not be taken in and internalized. And that's something that often people who study it on their own because they're motivated by this or that, you know, that only goes so far unless you're a very unusually self-motivated person.
And that these days seems to be hard to come by, it seems to me. Now, part one of the book is about Hebrew. That was Kathy's part. And then, Philip, you did Greek, the second part.
Right.
Each of you had about 10 chapters. Is that what I recall? Had about 10 chapters to talk about these things. Was there a chapter that sort of resonated with each of you? Kathy, we'll start with you. Was there just chapters that, oh, this was just my favorite chapter to write?
You're asking me to pick out my favorite chapter.
I know. It's like your favorite child, right? Which one is your favorite child?
I could say my favorite one today.
Okay. What is it today?
I actually really enjoyed writing these, but something that perhaps gets less attention. So when in chapter 9, when I'm talking about the battle that's being described in the book of Nahum and the way that the choice of vocabulary and the use of particular syntax, actually, if you were to read it out loud in Hebrew, you can actually hear the battle. And that is almost impossible to capture in translation, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, no, that's really terrific. Philip, what about you?
Yeah, I don't know if it was a favorite. I mean, like Kathy, I enjoyed the whole thing. Although I have to say, after doing about 4 of them, I hoped we were finished, you know, but there was still more to go.
Yeah.
And one of the later ones that I wrote, and I will call it one of the ones that was most satisfying to me, it dealt with the first chapter of Romans. Mm-hmm. And I think the title is The Poetics of,
Poetics of Divine Wrath.
That's it.
Yeah,
Poetics of Divine Wrath. And the reason I enjoyed it is because it was a longer stretch of passage. And in terms of things Paul has written, so many rhetorical features showed up there. I could look at the way in which a text can be framed or almost outlined, the way in which words that sound alike add force, and also see how the actual argument developed through that. So that, to me, started out as, I don't know what I'm going to do here, and ended up being a lot of fun. And also, I think it's a good illustration of how Greek, facility with Greek in this case, allows the student, the reader, inside the text to consider what's really going on. And I, like Kathy, too, we both wanted to avoid interpreting. Now, obviously, we go and we have to make interpretive decisions,
but
we weren't trying to pitch interpretations. We were instead trying to pitch an opening of a door so people could actually enter in with the languages and become interpreters themselves. And that was a chapter where I felt I was able to illustrate that well.
Well, that's a terrific way of sort of framing it. Recently, we had the Committee on Biblical Translation at our library for one of their meetings. It was during COVID, so not everybody could be present, but it still struck me as a lot of the people who were there just enjoyed their company, the company of one another. And yet, thinking about, some were in their 70s, some in their 60s and 50s, and I wonder who the next generation of biblical translators working on the NIV, because that was their job, the NIV, who are they going to be? Are they going to be as well equipped as a Doug Moo, you know, to work in Romans, let's say, or something like that? So one of the things I loved about the book is that from time to time you would take a quotation from various people, Scott McKnight. I'm reminded of Scott McKnight. But one of them was a former student of mine. His name is Christopher Fresh, teaches down in Australia. So it was fun to see that these other people sort of plugged into the book as well. Yeah. Were those your choices, or did you have, is that something the editors did with you?
Well, as far as I understand, and Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the idea that came from Hendrickson, from the editors, in order to, again, create a sort of interest in what we were trying to do that got beyond us, we ourselves. And I think most of the scholars who headed up the chapters I wrote, I selected and contacted students. It was completely up to Hendrickson to do that. Mm. I'm not sure, Kathy, if it worked the same with you.
It was a mix for me. I did recommend some students. Mm. And they did, I think, use a couple of those. And then the little introductions to the chapters, I think some of that actually came out of material I sent them. And then they also invited people to contribute.
Mm. Mm. Well, it's a delightful book. We're talking with Catherine McDowell and Philip Towner about their book, The Rewards of Learning, Greek and Hebrew, Discovering the Richness of the Bible in Its Original Languages. So it's a great book. I'm going to have my students, probably in the winter term, read this book together. I want them to know both the Greek and the Hebrew side of things. But thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel. Philip, as well as Catherine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, yes.
Hey, don't leave town just yet, because a nugget of wisdom is coming from one of our speakers. It's going to be this time Catherine McDowell. Thanks to Kathy Capes and Janet Seifert to help us produce the podcast. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. Be sure to subscribe to the Stone Chapel podcast and tell a friend, share it with a friend. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Well, Professor Towner and I have encouraged you to take that step and start studying the biblical languages. But the languages alone, while providing you with tremendous insight into Scripture, we also long for you to have the wisdom of God and to grow in the wisdom of God. And Proverbs 4 urges us in verse 6 and 7, do not forsake her, wisdom, and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom, and whatever you get insight. So Professor Towner and I encourage you, get Hebrew and get Greek, but don't neglect the wisdom of God as well.